Hi, it's Tracy. Before we start, I have a request. Okay, it's a little weird, maybe even a lot weird, but hello, 6.5 million downloads on my podcast, and still we haven't chosen a sponsor, right? Yeah, they just haven't been good enough for us, and that's a little weird too. So I decided I'm going to treat this like a sponsorship spot. Many of you know Marcus, my son, who's been the inspiration behind this podcast, the book, my programs, anything at all to do with ADHD. Well, he is graduating from NYU this May, and boy, are we happy that he did it in 4 years. So anyway, Marcus loves to travel, and so he's spending 6 weeks by himself traveling to 5 countries in South America. I don't know about you, but there's no way in hell that I would go to even one country alone. And so we gave Marcus a very low budget. This trip is a combination of his birthday and graduation gift, and he figured it all out himself. He speaks some Spanish, but he hired a Spanish tutor from Ecuador a couple weeks ago, months maybe, who's a professor at a university there, and this professor is helping him with his conversational Spanish. Marcus also changed his phone to Spanish only and all of his apps, and he only watches Spanish TV in preparation for this trip. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what Marcus is like. Now, Marcus would ultimately like to earn a PhD in psychology. He's fascinated by the brain, learning differences, and particularly how dyslexia impacts math. For the near future, though, he wants to work for a couple of years in New York City. I never thought he'd say that. He was always looking for more nature. So anyway, he's going on this trip, and what he's trying to do is find a job that he can come back to. He's come very close, but still no cigar. So yes, I am hawking my son's skills on these airwaves. He thinks I'm insane. But I'm like, who knows what interesting people are out there? I mean, I found my husband in a personal ad when no one was doing that. So why not find a job using my podcast? I mean, ultimately, finding a partner or finding a job, it's all the same thing, right? It's marketing, just getting the word out. Right job, right person. So that's my weird request. If you have any leads in New York City, Marcus would love to work in advertising or marketing sales. He's a phenomenal researcher. I promise you, he can find anything. He's very skilled in Excel and financial modeling. He'd be amazing in digital advertising or tech marketing. And beyond his hard skills, he's resilient. He's so smart. And he has an exceptional work ethic. And that's not just his mother talking. He's not like me. He prefers not to challenge the status quo all the time. He actually likes structure and systems. And he has so many ideas about how to make things better, faster, more efficient, simpler. So I'm putting this out there to our incredible community. If you know of any opportunities in digital advertising, tech marketing, or sales that are in New York City and could benefit from a bright, hardworking, and respectful young professional like my son Marcus, send me an email at support@tracyoutsuka.com and I will connect the two of you. Look, Marcus represents the very essence of what we talk about here every week, right? The brilliance of thinking differently. And so does his mother. So thank you for letting me be weird. And now let's get on with the show.
Learning to quiet that inner critic that perpetuates all of those negative beliefs that you kind of have gathered up because of your executive dysfunction. That is the key to living life successfully with ADHD.
Thomas Edison, Richard Branson, John F. Kennedy, Mozart, Michael Jordan, Will Smith. That sounds like a list of highly successful titans in a variety of vocations. Why is it that we rarely hear that they have or had ADHD? And you know what we hear even less about? Serena Williams, Emma Watson, Mel Robbins, Whoopi Goldberg, Agatha Christie, Erin Brockovich, Cher,
Yeah, the successful women navigating ADHD. And that's exactly why I started this podcast, ADHD for Smartass Women. I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka. I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, a lifelong student, now a coach. I'm also the creator of Your ADHD Brain is A-OK, a system that helps people like you figure out what they should do with their life. And we're here today to talk ADHD, your strengths, your symptoms, your workarounds, and how you proudly stand out instead of trying to fit in. I credit my ADHD for some of my greatest gifts. And you know what? I spy a happier life for you, too. So without further ado, a shiny new episode is starting now. I am your host, Tracy Otsuka. Thank you so much for joining me here for episode number 170 of ADHD for Smartass Women. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast and our newsletter over at tracyotsuka.com. My purpose is always to show you who you are and then inspire you to be it. In the thousands of ADHD women that I have had the privilege of meeting, I've never met a one that wasn't truly brilliant at something. Not one. So for all of these reasons, I am just delighted to introduce you to April Kane. April is a clinical psychologist who lives in Perth, Western Australia with her husband, seven-year-old daughter, I think almost eight-year-old daughter, German Shepherd Cross, and a not-so-nice cat. She grew up mostly in Melbourne, Australia, although also spent time living overseas in Malaysia and Indonesia. With the late diagnoses of ADHD and attentive type, April has had lots of career changes, twists and turns. After struggling to transition from high school to university and changing jobs every few months, April joined the Navy and served for 6 years before deciding to follow her heart and begin a psychology degree. After 12 long years, as well as working full time and becoming pregnant in the first year of her postgraduate degree, she eventually finished with a Bachelor of Science in psychology with first class honors and a master's in clinical psychology. Even as a psychologist, April has followed several different areas of interest. She has worked in a group private practice for nearly 5 years, seeing therapy clients and conducting different types of medico, legal, and forensic psychological assessments. And more recently has discovered a particular area of interest in adult ADHD assessments. April is also the operations manager and clinical lead and supervises mentors, early career psychologists. Phew, April, did I get all of that right?
You did get it all right, Tracy. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I have to ask you first off, I know that we're going to go to the ADHD diagnosis story. That's what we always start with, but I'm afraid I'm going to forget. What is medico-legal and forensic psychological assessments? What do you do in those?
Right. So forensic psychology is basically any psychology where there's some sort of legal context involved, right? So the medico-legal and forensic are sort of, they can sort of be bundled up into one, although we differentiate them at our practice. So forensic, yeah, as I said, anything with a legal context. So I do a lot of family court work, so single expert witness reports for families who are sort of caught up in the family court process, particularly around where there's issues with children and custody, I suppose, you know, who's spending time with who. And parenting capacity assessments. So we do have a good relationship with here what's called Department of Communities, Child Protection and Family Support. So Child Protective Services, essentially. I'm not sure what you call it over there in the States.
Same thing.
Yeah, so I guess, again, sort of assessing, yeah, doing really kind of robust assessments where parents have unfortunately not been able to look after their children, and it's resulted in their children being removed from their care. And sometimes it gets to a point where the department asks us to do an independent assessment, evaluation, and answer some questions that they might have about the parents' functioning and their capacity to be able to meet their child's needs across, you know, cognitive, social, emotional, those sorts of domains. which is really tricky, particularly when, you know, often people caught up in these systems are, well, yeah, much more often than not, are very traumatized, both the adults and the children. And yeah, so that's sort of the more forensic side of things that we do here, or that I do in my capacity at work. And medico-legal, sometimes, you know, if somebody's had an accident that's impacted their psychological functioning, or they might have had, you know, maybe like a medical trauma that's impacted them psychologically, quite often as part of the process that they go through with maybe trying to get compensation or trying to assess the damage or the impact on their functioning, we might be asked to do a psychological assessment and report back either to their lawyer or to the tribunal.
So the work you do with children seems like it would be so difficult for an ADHD person because of the emotional dysregulation. Like, I don't know, I couldn't do it. Is it as difficult from the outside it seems to be?
Emotional dysregulation for the children, you mean?
I'm talking about me.
Me, yeah. You know what? When I was in a completely different, won't surprise you to hear, I was in a completely different job as a psychologist before I went on maternity leave. And that was my first job as a psychologist. That job, what I knew was that I couldn't go back to that job coming off maternity leave for a number of reasons. And what I was interested in and still remain interested in is assessment. So I love assessment because I love putting the pieces of the puzzle together to try and, you know, figure out why people get to be the way they are. Why do we function the way we are? Like the way we do, why do we struggle with the things we do? I just love sort of understanding the whole person and all of the factors that have sort of led them to be where they are right now in the world and how they are in the world. And so when I came off maternity leave, I worked for a non-profit organization. I'm not sure if I should mention the name or not, but I worked for them just doing comprehensive assessments of children. So I assessed the children who had been taken into care and who were in the foster system. And what I did, you know, the context of that was providing feedback as to how their experiences up to that point had shaped them and had sort of impacted their development across various domains, and, you know, figure out the things that they struggled with and then make recommendations as to how we could best assist them to, you know, function better, make life easier. You know, what therapy did they need? What occupational therapy did they need? What, you know, educational interventions or supports might they need? And then, so that's that sort of coming off maternity leave with a 6-month-old baby, and I was still studying. I kind of dove into that work, and I thought, this is going to sound weird, I thought that I would find it really emotionally taxing, and I kind of worried a little when I didn't initially, because I was like, what's wrong with me? You know, I remember talking to my supervisor at the time and saying, you know, not that I wasn't upset, but I think there's a for me, when I work in assessment, there's an element of being really detached from, you know, you're sitting separate from what's going on, whereas working therapeutically with kids, I can see where that would feel much, much different. And I have done a bit of that. I choose not to do that work now in my professional life. I just feel that's not where my strength lies. Yeah, it is hard. It's sad, but it's also, to me, really interesting and I think really valuable when we can make recommendations that make sense and that improve people's lives. I think not all parties would agree. You know, there's always got to be someone involved in the assessment process, no matter if it's family court or parenting capacity or, you know, whatever context I'm doing an assessment and a report in, there's always somebody who feels probably as though, you know, the formulation's unfair or it doesn't quite, you know, I'm not necessarily agreeing and saying what they want me to say. which is the whole point, right? Like, is to be independent of the process and sort of gather all of the information, put it all together, and have it make sense to people who are not necessarily psychologically minded, who might not have these kind of insights about all the different factors and contexts that have this interplay.
What would it feel like to jump out of bed every morning in love with your career, your relationships, your life? If you find yourself lying awake at night wondering, who am I really? What would make me the kind of happy that doesn't fade after 2 months? Why am I clear on what I don't want to do, but clueless about how to figure out what I do want? Then join me for my free What Do I Do With My Life Masterclass, where we'll talk about how to become the expert on you and make better, quicker, and more confident decisions in your personal and professional life. Which of the many ideas that you have is the one you should actually pursue? And what would it really look like for you to live to your full potential? If this sounds like a fit for you, join me for my free What Do I Do With My Life Masterclass by going to spyhappy.me/class. See you there.
Well, it doesn't surprise me too that you'd be really good at taking all of the, well, ideation, right? You have all of these things that you're seeing all at the same time and being able to put them together in a way that maybe, you know, other people without your brain, they couldn't see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is, you know, it's one of the questions that I know that you ask, you know, later on, you know, what are your strengths? What are your ADHD strengths and how do they kind of work in your life? And I do really feel as though if my brain didn't work the way that it does, I probably wouldn't be able to make sense of these things in the way that I do. Not that other people who don't have ADHD can't do this work well, but I do feel like that really, you know, my strengths really, my
play
ADHD
to it.
Kind of, yeah, plays to that. So
wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the ADHD diagnoses first. I don't know if you want to start with childhood or you want to start with the diagnoses and then what you saw once you, you know, hindsight.
Yeah.
You tell me.
Okay, well, so for context, when I, you know, recently diagnosed, I was diagnosed in January of this year. Right. Yay. And it was such like a holding my breath moment. I just felt so emotionally invested in the outcome. And I really don't know what I would have done had I not received that diagnosis. Because I really believed in my heart and in my mind that this was true for me. Like, this is how I sort of had come to identify and understand myself. So I guess taking it back a little bit, what led me to pursue a diagnosis? When I first started working in private practice as a psychologist, and that was after that nonprofit job that I just spoke about. You know, I wanted to make a move and work therapeutically with people, not just do the assessments with the kids. One of my sort of first referrals was a young man who was. I got a letter from his medical practitioner that sort of said, you know, ADHD/anxiety, you know, for your opinion and management. And I thought, well, I don't really know anything about, I don't know much about ADHD. I sort of had that typical understanding of, you know, that people have or that thought, you know, you think of ADHD and you think of like a disruptive little boy in the classroom kind of, you know, calling out and having social difficulties and, just sort of challenging behaviors. And so, but this was a grown man and I thought, well, that's, you know, I hadn't sort of heard about ADHD being diagnosed in adults. I was very early in my career at that time. And I sort of thought, I said to the client, well, I don't know much about this. I do know that there's a really big overlap with anxiety. And certainly, yes, I can see you're really anxious and I hear that you're really anxious. But what we could do is, you know, let's do a brief screening tool just to sort of see if it indicates anything you know, if any ADHD kind of symptoms come up and whether further investigation is warranted. So we went through this checklist, and a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with this checklist. It's the ASRS, the Adult Self-Report Scale. And so I was going through the questions with this client and found myself sort of mentally ticking off many of the responses, like more than he was. And so that's when I had sort of not long finished my master's degree, my postgraduate studies, and I thought, wow, what if this is what's going on for me? Because I had this sense for a really long time that I was struggling, just kind of like scraping by, struggling through, you know, basically clawing my way through my degree, and, you know, doing really well, but, you know, externally doing really well, getting really great feedback, getting really high marks, and on the face of it, successful kind of academically. But the felt experience for me was just of things being really difficult, daily life being really difficult, keeping up with myself and with my schedule and with things like paying bills on time and remembering to go to appointments, and things were really hard for me. And I just thought, oh, that's just me. No, I'm just crap at adulting. I am just, you know, all of these kind of labels that we internalize for ourselves over our lives. And anyway, so that got me thinking, and that was in 2018. And I sort of didn't dare to even talk to my husband about it until late last year. I talked to a couple of friends about it. One friend who was very validating, and always is. She's a huge support. And, you know, other people, even other psychologist sort of friends who I mentioned it to, were kind of like, oh, yeah, no, you know, you're just describing what it feels like to be a woman, like to be a professional, successful woman, you know. And so I thought, you know, I'm probably pathologizing what's just a normal experience, and this is just how women who work and have children and manage households and all the stuff, you know, this is just how they feel, right? And so the thought that then I also couldn't keep up and struggled so much was really, I guess, like a bit debilitating and demoralizing. But anyway, I guess sort of some things happened for me last year, and I found that sort of that, you know, just keeping my head above water was becoming more and more difficult for myself. And I sort of thought, right, I really need to find out once and for all whether I do have ADHD. And if I do, I would love to be able to put a reason to why I struggle so much. So, yeah, that sort of led me to visit my medical practitioner and get a referral to a psychiatrist and undergo a very, very thorough assessment and, yeah, and be diagnosed early this year. So,
you know, I love talking to psychologists, psychiatrists, you know, other medical professionals who have gone through, and they have ADHD, and they've gone through all of this education, yet somehow it sounds like, you know, in many cases, you're not really trained in ADHD at all, but especially not when it comes to women and girls and what it looks like. Yeah. And I'm like, what the heck, April?
100%. Like, there's just sort of this, oh, you know, no, if you had ADHD, you would know about it because you're a psychologist. And so all of this self-doubt sort of comes into it. And, you know, the more I educated myself by, you know, your podcast, actually, Tracy, was a huge thing for me in terms of my, I don't like to use the word, but, you know, like my journey to understanding myself and understanding, you know, whether or not I related to and identified with having ADHD pre-diagnosis, listening to, you know, podcasts of lived experience and professional people speaking about ADHD, and, you know, reading you know, from reputable sources. You can find anything if you Google hard enough, but reading from, you know, reputable sources and, yeah, really educating myself on the differences. And the more and more I educated myself, the more I became much, much more certain that this is what was going on for me. And that's actually what made it even more difficult. I would use even maybe the word hurt, or yeah, it was a really, it became really emotional, a really emotional experience for me if I'd kind of put the idea out there tentatively to somebody and then sort of got the feedback like, no, you don't have ADHD, or yeah. So yeah,
kind of. I can so relate to that. And you said something earlier that you were so vested by the time you had done all this research because you knew it was ADHD. And I hear this from women all the time. I felt the same way. And I also, like in our big group, you know, the ADHD for Smartass Women big Facebook group, there are women who go in for a diagnosis every day and they're told, oh, no, you're too smart. It can't possibly be ADHD. Oh, you're a woman. Women don't have it. You know, I mean, just all of this misinformation. And I just can't even imagine what would have happened if someone had said that to me, because I was so certain too.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, it gives you a completely different lens through which to understand yourself and to understand what it is, you know, what's going on for you and why you struggle. And that's why it was so important to me. You know, I have a mentor who's I see her for supervision. She's wonderful. And I sort of said to her in one of our first sessions, it felt like this big confession, you know, early last year before I decided and pursued a diagnosis. I said, you know, I feel like there's something that you really need to know about me. I think that I might have ADHD. And then I kind of like waited for like some kind of reaction. And she was interested and curious. And that was awesome. And we kind of explored. She's kind of like, well, why haven't you pursued a diagnosis? And I became really emotional. And I said, because I'm scared about not getting a diagnosis. Like, I'm scared about what if I go through the assessment process and I, you know, the feedback is no, you don't have ADHD. She said, well, what would that mean to you? What would that mean about you? And I said, I got, you know, quite emotional. I said, you know, basically just that I'm a shit person. That would mean to me all of these things and these ideas and these labels that I've given to myself over the course of my life, which I now understand to be related to the difficulties I've had with my executive functioning, you know, things like I'm just lazy, I'm just unmotivated, I can't stick to anything, I'm just a failure. Even though objectively I'm not a failure, that's not what it feels like when you have these experiences over the course of your life that kind of build up into a really kind of intense feeling. So yeah, I said to her that was my biggest fear, that I would go down the path of being assessed and then what would I do with that if I didn't have, you know, if it turned out that I don't have ADHD. So yeah.
So tell me, once you knew it was ADHD and you had the benefit of hindsight, mm-hmm. what are some of the symptoms that you always wondered about, you know, from childhood on, that you now recognize them as, oh my gosh, that's clearly ADHD? And just, I think I mentioned you were diagnosed primarily inattentive. Is that correct?
Primarily inattentive. And I did question with my psychiatrist, which said there's a lot of evidence for inattentive on my profile, she says. And I know that because being me, I also kind of scored my own profiles and wanted to know what they looked like before I went to the appointment. I knew that there was a lot of evidence for inattentive, and I said, but I feel, I almost wonder sometimes, Tracy, if I have got like, you know, a combined type. But, you know, typical for women, we don't have this outward display of hyperactivity mm-hmm. and restlessness. We can experience it very internally, right?
Yeah, so, in our brain.
Yeah, in our brain and in our body. So, you know, I have this kind of internal restlessness and busyness that's really different from, you know, the inattentive kind of distractibility, like a little bit, you know, vague and flighty. It feels really different to me, although I have that too. And I do notice, you know, something. I'm quite, you know, I sit with clients, you know, I see 7 clients a day across the day, and you know, they're in discrete sort of 50 to 60 minute you know, blocks of time that I sit with my therapy clients. And even then, you know, like I'm a little bit restless. I think most of my clients would, you know, agree if I said, you know, if they were listening to this, they'd go, yes, she moves around a lot in her chair. You know, she's adjusting her posture all the time. So, yeah, I wonder if there's a little bit of combined type.
It sounds like combined type because there is external restlessness as well.
You know, and my psychiatrist said to me when I asked her that, she said, yeah, I don't see that. I don't see that for you. And I was like, oh, this is where I feel so frustrated. And not with her, but just with, you know, like this kind of really typical or stereotypical understanding of what it looks like for women and this, you know, the hyperactivity, we experience it quite differently, I think. So I agreed with her and I said, yes, I'm sitting here really nicely on your couch, you know, I'm comfortable. I noticed her, I said, you know, I'm sitting here like fiddling with the clasp on my bag the whole time. I'm like tapping my, you know, had my legs crossed. I said, you know, like I'm kind of tapping my foot back and forth.
And who cares what you're doing if you feel like you're going to jump out of your skin, right?
Exactly, right. And I said, but, you know, also, and this is another big thing about, you know, I think one of the reasons why women go, and little girls, you know, go so under the radar is that this kind of idea of masking, you know, we mask our symptoms. There's different expectations and rules and societal kind of, you know, ideas of for little girls, for females. And I'm using, you know, very simplistic, you know, male and female. And I understand there's a range of how people identify. But, you know, just to keep, you know, that kind of simple, you know, yeah, have these, you know, little girls are, you know, quiet and compliant and, you know, good, you know what I mean? This kind of idea of hyperactivity and there's like kind of different behavioral expectations, I think, particularly in primary school. And so when I think about myself in primary school and high school, you know, I was the helpful kid. I would get up and hand out the worksheets. I would probably go to the toilet and have a toilet break, even if I didn't really need to go. I, you know, was probably active in that way, but it wasn't obvious. It was just kind of seen probably as approval seeking, maybe. Yeah. And then sort of as a teenager, what did I notice? That's probably really maybe where the inattentive stuff started to become more prominent for me. Now, part of the diagnosis, right, I asked my parents for my old school reports and all I could find sort of because we moved around so much, things are in storage, different places. It's actually a miracle I could find any of them. But, yeah, I went through, I sort of had some high school reports and I went through and put tabs on all of the pages that where I felt there were comments that were red flags or, you know, pink flags because, you know, they didn't stand out at the time as being anything except, you know, she's disorganized. She just needs to organize herself better. She's always late with her homework. You know, why can't she hand things in on time? She lost marks for this big assessment piece because it was 3 days late. If she just tried harder, if she just applied herself, she's distractible and chatty and seems more interested in the social aspect of school than, you know, applying herself. And for goodness sake, like I was stunned when I put my school reports on the table and looked at all of these little post-it tabs that I'd stuck out of the pages and I felt so sad, you know. And when I came out to my parents and said, I've been diagnosed with ADHD, I wanted to be really clear and say, I don't want you to feel like I'm blaming you for not seeing something because I don't know if I would have met diagnostic criteria. Like, I don't know if there was enough impairment sort of through, you know, until I was in my mid-20s, mid to late 20s. Yeah. I just sort of wish that the research had changed sooner, right? And so, you know, the research has developed so much over the last sort of 30-odd years about what ADHD looks like in and how, you know, there's clear differences between males and females. And I wish that had come much earlier, so that I don't think I necessarily would have had different experiences, but I certainly would have had a different way to understand myself and perhaps be, you know, have a kinder internal voice, not be so critical of myself. And so this is why I'm sort of all over the place. I feel like I'm rambling. Sorry, Tracy.
You're actually not at all, April. In fact, one of the things that I've been thinking as we talk is I can see where, you know, I'm not with you, so I can't physically see you moving around, but just the way you speak, when I typically interview someone with ADHD, so I am super hyperactive. They wind me up because they're all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of trying to corral them, but then, you know, I'm wound up. And so I'm going all over the place versus you have this calm and your speech is very measured and thoughtful. Mm-hmm. So I could actually see how it could be missed. You just sound very intelligent.
Okay. Thanks, Tracy.
Not to say that ADHD people don't, but you know how, I mean, I certainly can start here and end up there and go over there and, you know, then I tie it together in a nice bow.
And I think, you know, and that's what I probably noticed conversationally that I, mm-hmm. you know, and I posted like a little bit of a, you know, one of those pictures, what are they, like a GIF or a GIF or a meme or uh-huh. something. And you're like, you know, this is a big thing in our work kind of group chat. And I posted one the other day and one of my supervisees just replied privately and laughed. And she said, yes, this is so you. But, you know, what I had said was something like, oh, I'm trying to find the message, but it basically like, you know, when you have everyone's attention, but you forget where your story was going, that is me conversationally. And I think sometimes professionally, like sort of depending on the client and my relationship with the client. But yeah, I think if you could see me, you said, I can't see you, but you sound very calm and measured. I'm talking so much with my hands. I'm gesturing all over the place, like kind of trying to show you, you know, I'm referring back to my childhood and I'm pointing over there. And so, you know, there are ways that it presents, but if you didn't know what you're looking for, if you didn't have the context of all of these other things going on, you know, for me personally, in my life, hearing the things that I struggle with or how my mind works, I think you wouldn't necessarily go, oh yeah, she's got ADHD, right?
Yeah. So when you were growing up, did you do pretty well in school? I mean, it sounds like you didn't do poorly enough to, you know, that there were any red flags.
No. I was a very, going to toot my own horn here. I was a very bright child, particularly in primary school. You know, I was really a really advanced reader. I was sort of in the top spelling groups in primary school and, you know, I didn't struggle in primary school. Yeah.
So, April, clearly you have a passion for educating and advocating for how ADHD presents differently in women and girls. So my question for you would be, in your experience, because you're in the trenches every day, what do you think the classic ADHD presentation is in girls? And I mean your classic, not the medical community's classic.
Yeah, so, I mean, can I refer to my daughter? Is that okay? Yeah, because I don't work therapeutically with kids, I don't, you know, see a lot of that in my practice. But what I do see, so my I see so much of myself in my daughter, right? My husband and I suspect, and this is part of the driving factor for me to try and, you know, to get my diagnosis, because we know the heritability is so high. You know, so I'll describe her, and I think probably she's quite typical of a little girl who, you know, and speaking to other friends, and I've got friends who are teachers in the primary school where she goes to, and other friends who are teachers, and I think the common thing that I hear from them is that, like, yeah, we just don't kind of see it. We don't see it in little girls. But what I see and what I would describe is, you know, she blurts out answers. So this is at school, right? She blurts out answers. She's super chatty. She can't, she knows she needs to put her hand up, but she just kind of struggles not to call out at the same time. She is really like, she, moves around a lot. So, you know, like she's one of those kids always swinging on her seat. I'm terrified she's going to knock her teeth out because she's going to fall off a chair and whack her face on the bench. She's messy and messy and then overwhelmed by mess at the same time. She's very busy. She's always doing, you know, a couple of things at the same time. You know, she can't just sit and watch a Disney movie. She's got to do that and color in, or do that and build a Lego, or yeah. I think, you know, the hyperactivity, I was having a chat with a teacher friend, and, you know, sort of, I was talking about this and, you know, saying, you know, we think that, you know, my daughter, you know, might, and she was doing something so typical of a kid with ADHD at the time. Her two little, so we were there for a play date. Her two little friends were sitting down. We'd had dinner. They were watching a movie on the TV, sitting nicely on the couch. My daughter had put on a pair of roller skates and was skating around their house whilst also keeping an eye on the movie. And I don't know, does that kind of explain, I don't know.
Yeah, she's just busy. She's so always busy.
So busy. And she has such an amazing way of describing what her mind feels like, which was also, so she's nearly eight now, and I reckon this was at least a year ago. So she would have been six. And we were talking about, you know, she'd gotten in trouble but she'd been told off for talking on the mat at school, and she was so upset about it, and, you know, really down on herself. And we were talking about it, and I said, she said, I just find it really hard not to talk. I know I need to not talk, but I find it really hard. She said, my mind doesn't listen to me. She said, my mind feels messy. And she said, it feels like there are butterflies flapping around in my head. And, you know, if someone calls out my name, you know, it might be like a clap and they all stop for a second and then they keep flapping. So then I was like, okay, all of this time at school, I've been, you know, since she started school, this is since she was in kindy and she's in year three now, pretty much every parent-teacher meeting we've had, I've said, yeah, do you think she's got, you know, sort of attentional issues? And early on I sort of wondered if it was just developmental because I didn't, you know, she was still very young and still developing, and I thought maybe she'll grow out of this kind of, you know, distractibility, this busyness, this having trouble kind of remembering instructions and then following them. And yes, they kind of said, yeah, no, it's just developmental. She'll grow out of it. She's just a little girl. You know, she just needs to learn to put her hand up. She just needs to learn to, you know, sit still on the mat sort of thing. But now having had those repeated conversations over probably 4 years now, I am like, oh, if I wasn't who I was, if I didn't do the job that I do, if I didn't have the insight that I have, and if I didn't also have my own diagnosis and therefore an enhanced understanding of this experience, if I was, you know, a regular parent, like not a psychologist parent, I probably wouldn't push. I'd be like, yeah, okay, that's just how she is. But I see it not improving as she develops. Actually, I see it, you know, starting to make much more of an impact on her functioning and her life. And so this is why I feel, you know, my experience, her experience, I think, you know, we haven't had her assessed yet, but I feel as strongly about this for her as I, you know, did about myself pre-diagnosis. And I think had, I've lost my train of thought, I don't know. I just might not think to pursue it. And I don't want, I think it's really important for, you know, people in general, not just girls, but I think probably inattentive type in general, you know, you can go under the radar and this is not picked up at all, or at least not until your adulthood. And by then, what sort of messages have you internalized about yourself? How do you see yourself in the world? It actually can have a really big impact on, you know, people's sort of broader psychological functioning, other than kind of ADHD stuff, you know, substance use and, you know.
So let's talk about that. When girls and women aren't diagnosed, how can that ultimately affect them? What have you seen? What are you seeing?
Right. So I think we have this kind of internalized sense of impairment. I think when I say we, like I'm speaking for everyone, this is my experience. And I think it's pretty typical from what I see in the group, right? In the mm-hmm. Facebook group, Tracy, people are talking about this stuff all the time.
Yeah.
And from what I hear of people on your podcast, from what I hear from talking to clients who I'm also now, you know, they're adult clients and I'm having this different lens to kind of see their challenges through and kind of taking a big deep breath, because I'm also not trying to paint everyone with the same brush and say, well, you have these challenges, you must have ADHD, but sort of going, you know, have you ever thought about this? And then we explore it and it makes so much sense. But, you know, essentially the common threads are, like I said, this internalized sense of impairment, feeling like not enough, like nothing I ever do will be enough, feeling like a failure, even if objectively,
so
you're not a failure, and just
so kind of imposter complex, perfectionism, these sorts of things.
Absolutely. You can overcompensate and become really perfectionistic, or we can kind of like a bit, you know, fall in a heap and become really dysfunctional because we don't kind of have that impetus to overcompensate and mask our symptoms. But, you know, we struggle with the day-to-day tasks of life and adulting, and then, you know, wonder what's wrong with me. You know, everybody else seems to find this, you know, adulting gig so easy and simple. And I think with females as well, we have much more of a tendency to kind of internalize our feelings and struggles. And that's, you know, partly because of gender differences and social expectations. But this common kind of experience of feeling something's wrong with me and then developing this really negative sense of self, you know, feeling, you know, there's a lot of self-blame, a lot of sort of self-criticism, some shame, guilt, feeling a bit defective. And then, you know, then we get these kind of labels about ourselves as though we think they're kind of character flaws. You know, this is just my personality. I'm just lazy and unmotivated and disorganized, and I'm sensitive and emotionally reactive. But actually, these things are just evidence of our executive dysfunction.
Especially, if you're trying so hard and you still can't do it, there's something else, right?
Right. Yeah, right. And, you know, trying so hard. And I've heard, I think, I can't remember, but probably a few times it's come up in your podcast episodes of people describing this experience. It feels like I'm living life on hard mode. And that is exactly, like, I can't come up with a better way to describe the overall felt sense and experience of this. But, you know, I'm on hard mode and I don't know how to, you know, change the game to go back to like normal mode.
Yeah. So when we spoke, you mentioned schema therapy. I think that's how you pronounce it. I've never heard of it, and I thought I've heard of everything as far as therapy, right?
Yeah.
What is it? And do you believe it can help really help women with ADHD?
Yeah. So I guess, schema therapy, I've talked about these labels and these ideas that we have about ourselves that we develop over the course of our lives because of these experiences that we have that kind of reinforce, you know, I'm not good enough, I'm a failure, I'm defective, there's something wrong with me. So basically, schemas are, in a really kind of broad, not technical way of explaining it, schemas are these ideas, right? These ideas that we have of ourselves. And it's more than idea, it's a really felt sense. So it incorporates thoughts, memories, beliefs, emotions kind of all bundled up into like a big messy, you know, collection
schema.
Of stuff. schema. Yes. And then we internalize this, and it really kind of can play out in terms of unhelpful patterns in our lives. You know, it's to do with our self-perception and how we view ourselves and how we think other people view us. It's not true and it's not factual, but it feels true and it feels real. And so these schemas, you know, kind of lead to unhelpful coping modes, ways of trying to cope with this overwhelming feeling that sort of can get triggered by, you know, things in our day-to-day. You know, for example, you know, feedback from somebody that's like a bit negative. Oh, of course, I'm such a failure. You know, it triggers that failure schema. But we have sort of developed these ways of coping to help us, you know, get away from that uncomfortable feeling. But they're not necessarily, yeah, healthy or adaptive. You know, there's like kind of avoidant sort of coping styles. There's overcompensatory coping styles and sort of surrendering when you kind of just, you know, give into it and it, you know, almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, like, you know, you're proving to yourself that it's true. So you talk a lot about in your podcast episodes, you know, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and why, you know, it's so helpful for ADHD. And I want to kind of really make a distinction. So CBT, absolutely, I think, can be really helpful with that here and now strategies to, you know, overcome those like blocks, mental blocks, you know, and emotions, you know, why am I procrastinating, kind of, you know, cognitive restructuring and challenging your thought processes and your feelings and to overcome the stuff that's happening for you right here and now. Whereas schema therapy is sort of, I see, is really complementary, particularly when people have had and internalized these messages over their whole lives, right? It's sort of going much, much deeper through the layers to see, you know, where did this come from? Why do I believe this stuff about myself? What are the coping styles that I use? And how can I develop sort of some more healthy coping styles? I feel like I'm not explaining it really well.
So are you basically saying that schema therapy is, the goal is to really understand yourself and why you do what you do?
Mm-hmm. Because why we do what we do and why we have these schemas essentially, you know, comes down to unmet emotional needs across our lives. So they might be a need for, you know, validation, reassurance, connection, you know, love. Yeah, when these needs are kind of consistently unmet because we perceive them to be unmet, or the people around us, you know, maybe a little bit misattuned to what's going on for us, that's kind of where the gap is. So what we're trying to do with schema therapy is, yes, have this understanding, but also have kind of healthier ways to meet, you know, what that need is.
So is it common that you would do schema therapy with cognitive behavioral therapy, or do you do it first and then, you know, how does it normally work?
Yeah. So, schema therapy integrates and combines elements of CBT. So there is a really cognitive and, you know, behavioral kind of elements to schema therapy, but it also, combines attachment theory, emotion focus therapy, and, you know, several other therapies and frameworks to really try to get to know all of these different parts of yourself and to help you to develop a more functional, healthy adult part who can recognize, validate, meet the needs of those vulnerable parts that are activated by our schemas, right?
So tell me the difference then between talk therapy and schema therapy.
Well, schema therapy is still talk therapy, mm-hmm. but there's also some really experiential elements to schema therapy. So it integrates And I'm just going to say, I'm not a schema therapy expert. Mm-hmm. It is an area of interest for me, but still very much an area of learning and development for me. Mm-hmm. So surely there's people who will listen to this and go,
No, they won't. I've never heard of schema therapy.
I missed something really important, but I'm trying to explain it in a way that it makes sense, but without getting too technical. So integrating other types, experiential methods, like things that you do in the therapy. So there might be kind of chair work, right, where you are basically talking to different parts of yourself from a more healthy perspective. You know, we might be talking to that really avoidant, coping part of yourself, and, or talking to the critic part of yourself, that really nasty voice that lives inside of your mind, and trying to, quiet it down a little bit. The part that I love the most is imagery rescripting. So, imagery is such a powerful tool in therapy in lots and lots of ways, but, essentially using imagery to kind of trace back these, feelings that might have come up with a recent example and go, okay, let's trace that feeling back. When's the first time you remember feeling that way? What was going on? Who was around you? What did you need in that moment? Right. And then re-scripting it, not to change the memory, but to try and change the way we relate to that memory so that it doesn't have such a powerful emotional connection. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense.
Yeah.
You're having, let's say women, because, that's who we deal with, at least here on this podcast. Mm-hmm. So you're having women think about things that they've never thought about as it relates to experiences.
Yeah.
I just had, something like that happen. And I was just, oh my gosh, I've never even thought of it that way. I can't remember what it was right now, but it was pretty major. I remember just, oh my gosh, no one has ever asked me that question. So I just took what I thought to be true as the truth, when in fact it really wasn't.
Absolutely. Okay.
And you think that this is especially helpful for women with ADHD because why?
Not because of their ADHD necessarily, but because of the messages that they've, messages, and i.e., therefore developed schemas about themselves, mm-hmm. that, over the course of their lives, because of their ADHD. So if I, thinking about my own sort of experience and the messages that I've internalized, about myself, I've done the schema questionnaire. It's part of the training, when you go and learn about schema therapy, you do the schema questionnaire. I've taken it to my psychologist and gone, oh, look at these schemas, And there are some really common schemas that come up for people with ADHD. And I think, there's probably still a little bit of a gap. There might still be a little bit of a gap in the research. There's not a lot of research. There's some with regards to schema therapy and ADHD and kind of the overlaps. But some of the common schemas that come up for people with ADHD are this kind of like defectiveness and shame. So feeling inadequate, there's something wrong with me, like I'm bad. Or mm-hmm. I'm, not good.
Too much.
Yeah, or too much, absolutely, is a really common one. Failure is another really common schema for people with ADHD. So, like, feeling like I haven't met my potential, I'm lacking, never enough, I'll never get there, I feel like mm-hmm. I've got to work harder than everyone else, I'm doomed to fail. And then this other schema, which is probably speaks more to the impulsivity that comes with ADHD, but that insufficient self-control. Mm-hmm. So it's this feeling like I struggle with self-discipline. I struggle to follow through on things. I make impulsive choices and decisions. I'm emotionally reactive.
I can't finish anything.
Yeah, I can't finish anything. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
So What are the ADHD traits that you feel are responsible for your success?
Yeah, I think sort of for me, big picture thinking, I don't think that's necessarily an ADHD trait, but I think I have this ability to kind of, I've got so much happening in my mind that I can just sort of make sense of things in a different way. My hyper focus has been, you know, a massive strength for me throughout my degree, you know, my education, particularly in my postgraduate studies and in my career. But it's also, you know, like it saved my bacon. But, you know, I sit down sometimes and I will get a week or 2 weeks worth of work or report writing done in 12 hours. But that's not necessarily functional. I'm trying to move away from that. But I think, you know, I have a really good sense of intuition, sort of gut feeling, and I think I'm quite socially attuned and socially intelligent. So that really does play into my work and how I do my job and how I relate to people and how I understand people. So,
yeah. Mm. And what do you think the key to living successfully with ADHD is?
Oh, being kind to yourself. For me, the most significant part of getting a diagnosis was that it gave me a different way to understand myself and the challenges and the things that I struggle with, more of a sense of self-compassion. It's been a huge period of growth for me personally and in terms of my professional interests as well. But I just think learning to quiet that inner critic that perpetuates all of those negative beliefs that you kind of have gathered up because of your executive dysfunction. That is the key to living life successfully with ADHD for me.
Well, and it's so brilliant because now knowing what you know, just the number of lives that you can now change, and then they in turn change more lives, and it just becomes this huge ripple, right?
100%, yeah.
It gets bigger and bigger. So is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have?
Gosh, I don't think so, but I think, you know, what I do want to say is I feel so passionate about educating people and advocating for, you know, and this has come from a really personal perspective, you know, looking at my daughter and me kind of being a psychologist and saying for 4 years at school, do you think she could have, you know, ADHD and being dismissed? Then I'm like,
tell me about it.
Right. I know that this is happening to other people. I know that, you know, speaking to teacher friends, they say, yeah, we, you know, I don't know what I'm looking for. I don't see it. And so, yes, there's been a massive shift in the research and how we understand ADHD, but it hasn't, that for some reason, it hasn't been disseminated. It hasn't translated into, you know, for us, at least in Australia, the education system.
Yeah, no, I would completely agree.
Yeah. So I think then there will continue to be this gap in people not being diagnosed because, They, educators, teachers, people, they have such a big input into diagnosis. And if they're not knowing what they're seeing and looking for or at, how can they report on it effectively and reflect on, you know, a child's experience and how they are, you know, at school? Home is a different story. I just think there's a big gap.
In school, and I don't know if it's this way in Australia, but I still get this sense that it's about, you know, that child has a moral failing or a character flaw. That's why they're behaving that way. Yeah. And, or their parents are bad parents.
Yes, you know, absolutely. They just have no boundaries, no structure, no rules.
Exactly.
That's not it at all. And, you know, I just, it makes me so sad to feel that, particularly, I think particularly like little boys with ADHD get this a lot, and it makes me sad. And I think, yeah, the conversation about neurodiversity needs to change a lot. and our understanding of that needs to change, because, you know, they're labeled things like naughty. You know, that's the naughty kid. That's the disruptive kid. That's the, like you said, like a character flaw. And it's not what they just, what they need is a you know, they need people to relate to them differently. Yes. So that they can thrive in that environment.
Absolutely. And they need to be listened to.
Yes. Yes.
They usually have the formula, right?
Yeah.
Just like we do. If we do it our way, we can do it. We just can't do it your way typically.
That's it. And that's my daughter to a T. She gets so frustrated and stressed around homework stuff. If we're kind of trying to, my husband and I are trying to help her, you know, with her homework or we're supervising her homework, she's so frustrated with us if she can't do it her way. And so really allowing that kind of just resolves a lot of issues and distress and frustration on all sides.
Absolutely. So April, where can people find you if they want to know more about you and what you do?
Well, I work in a group private practice, Perth Psychology Collective in Perth.
What is it called? Perth Psychology?
Perth Psychology Collective. And that's our website, perthpsychologycollective.com.au. There's a gap in services for people, particularly in Australia, being diagnosed and, you know, getting on a wait list to see a psychiatrist is a huge amount of time. You know, we are doing ADHD assessments at the clinic where I work at Perth Psychology Collective, and not for children, but for adults, we are able to do these assessments by telehealth, so via a video link. So even if you're located elsewhere in Australia, you're not in Perth, we're able to offer that service via video, and at least, you know, get people a thorough assessment and some feedback and, you know, diagnostic clarity around what could be going on for them.
So how long does that normally take?
Is it a
series of a couple appointments
of appointments? You know, we use a couple of different psychometric tools or measures, questionnaires and you know, executive functioning measures. And then, you know, we integrate that with a structured clinical interview that is specific to ADHD, as well as like a background sort of interview where it's a little bit more conversational and getting an idea of this person and what their life's been like, and making differential diagnoses as well, as you know, Tracy, is super important. So ruling out things like bipolar and ruling out or in, because they can be comorbid. There's no reason why someone couldn't have both. But just trying to provide diagnostic clarity around what's going on for the person is really important. I'm online, as are the rest of the team here. We are sort of, kicking off. We've done some professional development and sort of trying to develop this ADHD assessment side of things. Mm-hmm. I have a personal/public Instagram profile, which people are welcome to follow if they want, but it's really just, you know, motivational, like going to the gym stuff for me, because that's a really big part of how I manage my self and my symptoms.
What's that Instagram handle?
Oh, the Instagram handle is Journey365. So all in words, except the six is a number six. So at Journey365. And I may well actually be starting another sort of, ADHD kind of advocacy and educational sort of related social media and other stuff in the near future. And so if people follow that Instagram, I'll make an announcement on there for where people can find me when I'm ready to set that up and have it up and running and functional.
Wonderful. So we will have, I'm going to read it again. It's perthpsychologycollective.com.au. Did I get that right?
Yes, you did.
Okay. And then at Jenny 3 spelled out.
Sorry,
a number six, and then you spelled out five.
Okay, I think that's my accent here at Journey. So J-O-U-R-N-E-Y, Journey. Uh-huh. Journey.
Okay, Journey.
Journey.
Okay. And then is it just 365, the numbers?
Okay. Three in a word, six in a number, and a five in a word.
Okay.
Yeah.
Regardless, we will have this in our show notes.
Yeah.
April, thank you so much for spending time with us here today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Tracy. I've been really excited to talk to you and to, try and get this message out there, which I think, you know, listeners and followers of the Facebook page know this really well, but, you know, the more that we can talk about it and try and involve other people, the more we can be heard as a community.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's what I have for you for this week. If you like this episode with April, please let us know by leaving a review. Our goal is to change the conversation around ADHD, helping as many women as we possibly can learn how their ADHD brains work so that they too may discover their amazing strengths. And your reviews? Yep, they really help. As always, you're listening to ADHD for Smartass Women. Come join me over at tracyoutsuka.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you here next week. You've been listening to the ADHD for Smartass Women podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Outsuka. And we're available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Not coincidentally, ADHD for Smartass Women, it's also the name of our free Facebook group. We're a totally smartass community of successful, ambitious women who share our ADHD wins, questions, and workarounds. Join us at tracyoutsuka.com, where you can also find more information on our Your ADHD Brain is A-OK system. I spy a happier life for us, and I'll see you again next week. It's me again, Tracy. You know how people often assume that if you have ADHD, you're just lazy, unmotivated, and not living up to your full potential? Well, I'm here to tell you they've got it all wrong. Except for the part about not reaching your full potential. But that's only because you haven't found the right strategies tailored for your unique ADHD brain. And that's exactly why I wrote ADHD for Smartass Women. This book, it's designed to help you understand the different approaches that work for your distinct brain, inspiring you to become the best version of yourself right now. You can grab a copy wherever books are sold. And if you've already read my book, please take a moment to leave a review on Amazon and Goodreads. Your feedback, it not only supports me and my publisher, but it also helps other smartass women and their kids, friends, and colleagues find the strategies they need to thrive. Every review makes a huge difference. So go write a review now or buy the book now before you forget. Okay, back to our usual programming.